So Birshus, the Rosh Yeshiva, all the Rabbanim present, the Weissman family, and my parents. So I'm going to be speaking about the topic of gene editing in Halacha and Hashkafa. Now, in the Halachic literature, there hasn't been so much about this topic because it's relatively new technology. And also, it's the technology that we've had previously for this kind of gene editing hasn't come out to the practical so much. It started in about like the 1970s. They started doing gene therapy procedures and trials, and it went into the 80s and the 90s. And the way that they did it in the past was they basically took a virus and they put their intended DNA in that virus and then injected it into humans. And then eventually it led to FDA-approved drugs in the 2000s. But still, most of it was more in the theoretical than the practical. And this type of gene editing was very expensive. So it wasn't so practical. But that all changed with the introduction of CRISPR, the discovery of CRISPR. So what exactly is CRISPR? So CRISPR stands for Clustered Regularly Interspersed Palindromic Repeats, which is a mouthful, so they obviously call it CRISPR. So it makes sense. So CRISPR is something in bacteria which is discovered in the 90s. They didn't understand what exactly the function of it was when they first discovered it. But then in 2005, the function of it was discovered. So basically, viruses attack bacterial cells, and they do this by injecting their DNA into the bacterial cell's DNA. And then the DNA from the virus takes over the machinery of the bacteria and creates more of itself, more viruses, and that fills up the bacterial cell with viruses until the point where it's so full that it explodes, and then the viruses escape and they go to their next victim. So a way that the bacteria is able to defend itself against viruses, it has a kind of an immune response, which is CRISPR. Basically, whenever a bacterial cell survives a virus attack, it'll take the DNA from the virus and it'll place it in its own DNA. And then now it has a record of what that virus looks like. So now the next time that virus tries to attack, the DNA from the bacteria is translated into RNA, which is like movable DNA. And that RNA attaches itself to a protein, which is called Cas9. So you have two components. You have Cas9, a protein, which is used as like molecular scissors to cut DNA. And then you have the other component is like the GPS coordinates. That's the RNA, which tells it which virus to look for. So you have those two together, and they form a complex. And now it'll be able to go out and find where the virus DNA is that's trying to attack the cell. And the molecular scissors, the Cas9, is able to cut up the virus DNA so that it can no longer harm the cell. And then bacteria, over many years, collected obviously a lot of different viruses and passed it along in its DNA to its progeny. So it was used as an immune response to defend itself against viruses which attacked. So this is discovered in 2005 by a yogurt company, which then used it to protect their bacteria, which is in their yogurt, from virus attacks. Then in 2012, the real chiddush of CRISPR-Cas9 came. So they realized that they could take this machinery, which was in bacteria cells, and they could program it themselves. Previously, the bacteria attached the RNA to the protein and decided where it went. But a team of researchers in UC Berkeley realized that they could program the complex themselves and tell the molecular scissors where to go and what to cut. And then another research team in MIT at the same time, they realized that you could also inject this type of machinery not only in bacteria cells, but you could take it and move it into plant cells or to animal cells and to human cells. So these two research giants, MIT and UC Berkeley, discovered this, and they both filed for patents and are still fighting in the courts over who has the rights to this technology. So the CRISPR-Cas9 combination is able to be used in all different types of cells, and we're able to program it ourselves, and it's an extremely cheap, it's really effective, it's very precise. All the gene therapies we had in the past, you kind of just placed a piece of DNA randomly throughout the DNA. But this one, you're able to precisely either change or add or subtract a specific DNA gene which you wanted to either remove or add. And it cheapened it by over 99% the previous technologies. And it changed it from taking maybe even a few years to actually do gene editing to taking only a few days and maybe only a few hours. So it was really innovative, this discovery, and kind of changed the face of science. So most labs in the U.S. and really worldwide today that are involved in the genetics are using this CRISPR technology. Even in Yeshiva University, in my lab this past summer, in Dr. Steinhauer's lab, we used this technology to cut out a specific gene in the fly genome in our flies to see exactly what that gene did. And previously, we had ways to do this, but it wasn't as accurate. Now we could exactly know that this exact gene was cut out. So, like I said, labs across the world are already using this technology. Just to throw out a few examples, there's a lab in China that they gene-edited embryos of pigs so that now they took out the entire immune system of the pigs so that they would be able to catch diseases, and now the scientists could test different medicines on those pigs. And it made it much easier to test out new diseases. And another lab in China, they edited a gene called myostatin, which affects muscle growth in the animal, and they enhanced it. So now these dogs, they changed their embryo, and now the fully formed dogs had stronger hind legs. So they actually changed the strength of the dog. And there's also a lab in the U.S. which has worked with monkeys who are blind, and they injected this CRISPR-Cas9 technology into the monkeys and were able to repair some of the vision of the monkeys. And lastly, there was a lab that injected this CRISPR-Cas9 system into mosquitoes to make these mosquitoes malaria resistant and prevent the spread of malaria. So these are technologies that have been actually used and have been successful. And there are a lot of future applications for this type of technology. The possibilities are really endless. Just to name a few potential applications which have been discussed, and there already have been companies founded to further these ideas. They want to create fire-resistant plant-based building materials lighter than aluminum. They want to create fully biodegradable plastics. They're thinking about creating allergy-free foods by taking out just one of the two proteins which cause allergies to eggs, let's say, for example. They want to create algae biofuel by making the algae create more fat and turn it into biodiesel. They want to improve the yield of our food supply by enhancing and creating larger wheat stalks and larger corn stalks, for example, to potentially end world hunger. So the possibility for this type of technology is really endless. And in the next few decades, or maybe even a few years, our world is probably going to look radically different because of these technologies. So many halacha questions can come up with this kind of technology. Just to name a few potential questions, what would happen if you edited out the scales of fish to make it easier to clean? Would the fish still be kosher? Or if you did the same thing with splitting hooves or chewing its cud of an animal, or vice versa, if you added that in to the genome of an animal that wasn't kosher before, what would be the status? And what would be the status of an esrog if you changed the genome so now it was more like a lemon? Would it still be considered an esrog? And what if you took a vegetable and changed the gene so now it would grow on a tree, so it'd be safer from bugs, let's say? Would you still make a adam on it, or would you make haetz? So there are a million different questions that can come out of this, the halacha. So even though the applications are really wide-ranging for this type of technology, I want to focus on one specific part, I think, which is the most important application of this technology, which is in editing human genes. So humans have about 20,000 genes in our genome, made up of about 4 billion nucleotides, 4 billion letters that make up our DNA. And there are 6,000 known diseases which are caused by one mistake in just one of those letters or nucleotides. Just one mistake causes a genetic defect. So we know of 6,000 of those kinds of diseases which are caused by a single mutation. And there are probably more that we haven't found out about yet. And there are also many other diseases which are caused by genes that involve multiple genes. So just to name a few which are single cell, which are caused by one mutation: Huntington's disease, sickle cell anemia, hemophilia. So by using this technology, we could potentially prevent these diseases from ever happening. An example of how CRISPR could cure disease in humans, another example, there's a disease called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, or HCM, which is a heart condition that one in 500 people worldwide suffer from, which isn't such a small number. The symptoms are painful, it can potentially lead to cardiac arrest because it causes the tissues of the heart to harden. So even though modern medicine has enabled these people to live longer lives, but it's still an uncomfortable life. And using gene technology, gene editing technology, they could potentially get rid of this disease. So in the summer of 2017, there was a study carried out where 54 embryos were gene edited to remove the gene or to edit the gene to prevent HCM from occurring. And out of those 54, 36 of them came out that they were completely free of the disease, and 13 were partially free of the disease. So that has already been done and was partially successful. And so that's pretty promising. Another example of how we could apply CRISPR to humans is that of HIV. So there's a gene called CCR5, which serves as the receptor to the immune system cells, which get attacked by the HIV virus. So by removing the receptor, we can prevent the virus from ever taking hold. So this kind of gene editing has actually already been done in humans. In the beginning of 2018, a researcher in China secretly carried out a trial where he recruited couples who wanted to undergo infertility treatments, and he gene edited their genes. Both parents had HIV, so he wanted to prevent the children from receiving the HIV. So he gene edited the CCR5 gene, which we just spoke about, and he actually went ahead and implanted those embryos back into the mother. Now, that was completely legal. The entire, many countries have outlawed implanting those embryos. There's some research going on with embryos and gene editing embryos, but the embryos are completely destroyed after a few days. No one has implanted an embryo actually in a human yet. So he went ahead and did it secretly without telling anybody. And then in October of 2018, the beginning of this year, the babies were born. There were two girls which were born, and they were the first gene-edited embryos to ever be born. And he claims they were born fully healthy. One of them was completely immune to HIV, and the other one, he said, was partially immune. And he announced this in a conference in November of 2018 at a big genetic conference. And all the scientists got very upset at him because they had said that there was going to be a moratorium. No one's allowed to implant this, any of these gene-edited embryos into human beings, and he did it anyways. So it ended up being that he lost his job from his research position in a university, and he's being investigated currently and is probably going to go to jail for what he did. But the point is that this technology is actually real, and it's no longer theoretical. It's already been used in humans. So now I want to go into the different issues, both halakhically and hashkafically, with actually gene editing human beings. So first I want to make two clarifications. I want to first differentiate between two different types of gene editing. There's gene editing of already of adults and adult cells, which that would potentially be much easier halakhically. There'll still be hashkafic issues, as we'll discuss at the end, but halakhically it'll be much easier. But at the same time, it won't be as effective, because once a person is fully formed already and they have billions of cells, it'll be very hard to inject enough of the CRISPR-Cas9 system to change that disease in every single cell or in enough cells to make a difference. So they're already conducting trials with this in actual human beings who suffer from terminal diseases. And then there's also gene editing of embryos, like the scientists had done, which on the one hand is much more effective, because if you nip it in the bud and you do it right in the beginning, you'll be able to affect all further cells that come out of it. But at the same time, that'll potentially be more halakhically problematic, as we'll discuss. And then the second qualification is that I want to differentiate between therapeutic usage of gene editing and gene editing for enhancement purposes. So therapeutic refers to curing disease or preventing disease, and enhancement is anything but that. If someone wants their child to have blue eyes, so they'll change the gene for eye color to blue, or if they want their child to be faster or stronger or taller or whatever, so that would all be under the category of enhancement. So already the Rabbanim who have addressed gene editing, such as Rav Bleich and Rav Tendler, have drawn the line between therapeutic and enhancement for gene editing. And they say that therapeutic, that would be okay, but for enhancement, then that would be a problem, because it's a slippery slope. We're going to end up with designer babies, and every single thing we're going to pick out from our children, it would lead to mayhem. So I'm going to specifically discuss gene editing for therapeutic purposes, and mostly within affecting an embryo. So there are many different potential halakhic issues involved. The first question, and the way that anyone begins a medical halakhic year, is how do we have the right to even heal disease or to prevent disease? Maybe since HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave that person the disease, then they deserve it, and therefore we shouldn't mess with that the divine will. We shouldn't touch it. So the Gemara Baba Kama already, since the Shiva is a learning Baba Kama, and Pei Hei Amud Aleph says in source number one, Tani Debei Rabbi Shmuel Omer, V'ra Po Yirapei, that based on the pasuk of Rav Poyerpei, a doctor has the right to heal his patients. And the Tosos on the spot over there says, why do we need a double lashon of Virat Poyarape in source number two? So he says, V'yesh lomar, dehav amina, hanimili, mak b'de adam. Maybe a doctor only has the right to heal his patients if it was from one person to another, if someone hurt somebody else. Then a doctor could heal that kind of wounds. But avocholi hababi de shemayim, but as an illness or sickness that came directly from Hashem, came naturally, then kishimarape, so when you attempt to heal it, nira kisos or gzeiros hamelech, it's as if you're going against the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because he wanted this person to be sick. Kamashmalan dishari. So then the second Yerape comes and teaches that no, you still have the right to heal such a person. So you're allowed to heal all types of illnesses, whether they came from one person to another or whether they came naturally. So the Rambam in source number three gives another source for the potential mitzvah to heal. And he says, Shechayev harofe min adin l'rapos chole Yisrael. That a person, a doctor, is chayev, not just the rishus, but he's actually chayev to heal the sick. Vareu b'chlal amram b'perish ha-kosov v'ashevosa lo l'rabos eskufo. And it's included in the mitzvah of Vashivosela of Hashavas Aveda. That includes also healing somebody. That not only do we have to return the lost object, we have to return their life and we have to return their body. And there's a medrash also, the medrash Shmuel says, brings a story of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel who are walking with another person and they bump into somebody who's sick. And the sick person goes up to Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Akiva and asks them, what medication should I take for such and such illness? And they answer that you should take whatever medication, a specific medication. And then the third guy that's with Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Akiva, he asks them, how could you go ahead and tell this person what to take and give him medication when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him that illness? And he obviously wanted him to have it. What gives you the right to intervene? So Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Akiva asked the guy back, what do you do for a job? And he answered that, I'm a farmer. So they asked back, and who created the ground? And the guy said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so they asked, well, what right do you have to go and work the ground in order to create vegetables and fruits for yourself? And the guy answered that, well, if I didn't work the ground, then nothing would come from it. So I have to work the ground and water the ground and water the plants in order for the fruit and vegetables to grow. So Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Akiva say back that it's the same thing with a human being. A human being is just like the ground. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us our bodies, and we have medication which serves as like the fertilizer and working the ground, and we have to give those medications in order to heal the body. So the doctor is like the farmer, that he of course has the right to heal the human body, just like a farmer has the right to work the ground. The Ibn Ezra, in source number five, he has quite a strict limitation on the directive of Virapo Yerape. He says, Virapo Yerape, Laos Shenitan Shnasan Rashus Larofin Larape, Hamakos, Vapitsoim Shiur Bachutz. He says that a doctor has permission to heal the wounds that are on the outside. But Ra Kol Chole Shehu Bifnim Bagof, but any illness that's on the inside of the body, Biad Hashem Laraposim, that's up to Hashem to heal. And doctors don't have the right to heal that. So he's the most extreme in terms of Virat Poyarape. But Shulchan Aruch in source number six seemingly paskins against that, and paskins like Tosos that there's no limitation on the healing. And Shulchan Aruch says, Nitna HaTorah Rishus L'Rofe L'Rapos, that the Torah gave permission to a doctor to heal. U'mitzvah, not only is it does he have permission to heal, but it's actually a mitzvah to heal. U'b'chla b'kuach nefeshu, v'moneah atzmo, and if one has the ability to heal and he doesn't, then hareza shofet tamim. It's as if he's murdering the person if he doesn't heal. So the Shulchan Aruch isn't mechal. He doesn't differentiate at all between the types of illnesses, whether they're on the inside or the outside, or whether they came naturally, or whether they came from another person. He just says flat out that you have rishus and you have a mitzvah to heal. So lechor, this would apply to therapeutic usage of gene editing as well. That we have rishus and we potentially have a mitzvah to heal based on either vashivosela or based on virapo yirape. So the next question is, are there any Yisurim involved in the actual gene editing? So the next question we have to address really is, what about the risk involved? So right now, as it stands, gene editing, as the scientific community has said, is extremely dangerous, and that's why they don't allow any implanting of these genetically engineered embryos, or gene-edited embryos. So it's too risky at this point. For example, for the HIV patients, which were gene-edited, it's been discovered that if they remove that receptor, they are less likely to get HIV, but they're potentially more able to get West Nile virus. So there's kind of give and take with every action that you're going to do. So as science moves along and as this technology moves along, we're going to need to address all the risks involved in the gene editing of these embryos. And we'll have to assess what exactly are the costs and what are the benefits, like we would in any other medical procedure. And then Rabbanim and Poskim will have to be asked if they're allowed to do such a procedure, and it'll depend on the severity of the disease. Is it fatal or is it just uncomfortable? So that'll be the next issue, dealing with the risk involved. But once you get out of the risk issue, and it is permissible in terms of risk, then are there any other problems with the actual action of gene editing? So how would gene editing be done in an embryo? It's basically done with IVF, which is in vitro fertilization, where you take the eggs out of the mother and you take the sperm from the father and you place it in a petri dish and have fertilization outside of the human body. And so there are multiple issues which are involved in IVF. And also there's another procedure called, a form of IVF called PGD, which has already been used, which is called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, where we basically look at the embryos that are fertilized and any of them that have any diseases, because we can check the genes, we look at the genetic makeup, and if they have any diseases, then we'll remove it. And then if it's good, then we'll implant it in the mother. So whatever issues are involved in IVF and PGD will also be involved in genetic engineering and gene editing with CRISPR-Cas9, because we'll need to do the same thing. We'll have to fertilize outside of the human body, and we'll do it in a petri dish, and then we'll inject the embryo, the newly fertilized embryo, with this CRISPR-Cas9 technology with our specific GPS coordinates plugged in. So what are the issues involved in IVF and PGD? So the first potential issue is that of what's the status of those embryos? They're only a few days old or even only a day old. They've just been fertilized. What exactly is the status? Are they considered a full human being? Because in these procedures, the eggs that don't actually, the fertilized eggs which don't take on the changes, then we're just going to throw out. And that's what they do in IVF and PGD, and that's what we would do with the CRISPR-Cas9 technology. If the technology didn't work and we can test it and see it didn't work, then we'll throw away the embryos. So is it a problem of Shfichas Damim to throw away those extra embryos? So in source number 7, the Gemara Nivamos in Samach Tesam Bey says that up until 40 days, Adar Boyin, until the 40th day from conception, Maya Ba'almahi, the whatever is formed from those two, is just considered water. It's just fluid. And this has a couple of nafkaminas la'alacha, but it seems like the status of an embryo within the 40 days counts as nothing. And the Tzitz Eliezer says that it would be mutter to throw away a fetus if it's under 40 days. And the Ragvashavar also quotes many poskim who say that they're not so stringent with under 40 days. But Rav Yisri Yehuda Unterman, who is the former chief rabbi of Israel, he argues that abortion, even within the first 40 days of conception, would be a problem, would be usur, because even though it's not a fully formed human being yet, but it's a suffix nefesh, it's a potential human being, and therefore, he says it would be avak shvichas damim. So it seems like it's machlokas what the status exactly is. But there will also be potentially another reason why we would be mutter to throw away these embryos in IVF and PGD and gene editing. As Rav Shechter mentioned when I spoke to him before, that these embryos are outside of the womb. They're not even implanted yet. So for sure you could throw them away. And Rav Avram Steinberg, who's the head of Encyclopedia Talmudit Institute, and he writes a lot on medical halacha, so in his discussion of gene editing, he brought the Chacham Tzvi, which is in source number 8, where he explains that the Isser Shvichas Damim does not apply to something which is outside of the womb. The Chacham Tzvi is talking about what's the status of a golem, of a human-like being which is created through Sefer Yetzira or something, and what exactly is the status of that human being? Is one allowed to murder such a human being-like creature? So the Chacham Tzvi says that the pasuk of which talks about murder, which says Shofech Dama Adam Be Adam Damo Yishafech. He says that it specifically only applies to dam ha'adam be'adam, only a person inside of another person. Only when a person was born from a womb would the iser shvichas damim apply. So he says it wouldn't apply to a golem. And Rav Steinberg wants to extend that to these embryos as well, which have not been implanted yet inside of the mother. So therefore, it would be fine to throw away the ones which have not had the changes done to them yet. So that's the first issue which we need to tackle and possibly need to be need to address before we can move to the next issue, which is also involved in IVF and PGD and gene editing, and that's Hotzah Zera Levatela, wasting the human seed. So are we allowed to do these procedures if we're going to potentially waste the human seed? So the Marasham, who lived in the 1800s, Rav Mordechai Shodron, he says in one of the Shalos Tshuvos that in source number 9, that when you're doing it for fertility purposes, he's discussing some type of fertility treatment that they had back then. So when you do it, it's not considered begeder ashkasa. It's not, you're not destroying the seed. Kevin the efshar she'osa zera atzma lo telech ibur levatala, because that zera itself won't go to waste. Maybe va'af shehi rak safik tikun, even though it might not actually work, we're not sure if it's going to work. Still, it's mutter demi kol makom lo havi derech ashkasa. You're not doing it for the sake of destroying it. Kevin she'osa b'shvil tikun, you're doing it in order to bring a person into this world. You're doing it for a purpose, even if some is wasted in the process, but it's not really wasted because you're working towards solving this fertility issue. So therefore wouldn't be Otzar Zer Levatela. And Rav Avadia, who's quoted in the first volume of Tchumim, an article about these kind of thing procedures, he says that Rav Avadia is quoted as saying that it's completely mutter, and it's not an issue of Ashkata Zer Levatela, based on this Marsham, and he quotes a bunch of other poskim who agree. But he does quote some who disagree. Rav Malkiel Tzvi Tenenbaum quotes, and Rabban Zion Azriel, who say that it is Kemotzi Zera Levatela, and therefore IVF and PGD and gene editing wouldn't be able to get off the ground, would be a problem according to them. But La Halacha, it seems like most in our community are Mekel and Roshechter. When I asked him, he said that it's not an issue of Hotzah Zera Levatela, and we can see based on this Merosham that it wouldn't be a problem as long as you're doing it for the sake of Tikkun. There's a purpose to it. So those are the two big halakhic issues involved in potentially doing gene editing in human embryos. There are some have quoted another reason why we would say gene editing is going to be mutter. The action itself is going to be mutter. So Rav Israel Rosenfeld, who was a musmach of YU back in the 50s, so he wrote in an article in Tradition in 1972, he says that there's no isser on something which is so tiny that it's microscopic. As we see by shrutz and by bugs, there's no isser to eat bugs which the naked eye can't see. You don't need to go under a microscope and see and try to find the bugs, he says, because then it would be impossible to drink any water because there's always bugs. As the Aruch HaShulchan says in source number 10, in the middle, Amnam ha'emes hu delo asr Torah b'mesha eina ayin shaletis bo, that the Torah didn't ask for anything which was not visible to the eye. Delo nina Torah l'malachim, because the Torah wasn't given to malachim. And he mentions earlier that we wouldn't be able to breathe because there are microbes in the air. There are different types of small, tiny bugs that are floating in the air, and we wouldn't be able to breathe if that was the case. And he says at the end, kevin she'ein ha'ayin sholei b'hem lav klumi, since the eye can't see them, can't see these bugs, so they're nothing, and they're not going to be usher. So Rav Zvira Rosenfeld wants to extend this to gene editing as well, because he says that the way we do gene editing is on such a tiny level, it's on a microscopic level, we're changing the DNA, so that's so tiny that therefore it can't be aser, just like Machalos Asuras, just like the Shratzim can't be aser. But the Nishmas Avram quotes Rav Neuwirth and Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach as disagreeing with the Sfara to as a heter for gene editing. They say it might be mutter for other reasons, but not because of this, because they say that even though the actual action is microscopic, but the repercussions, the effects of the gene editing are anything but microscopic, because it can change an entire organism. So therefore, this Sfara wouldn't apply to gene editing. And Rav Neuwirth says that it's the same thing with electricity. If we would say that anything microscopic is mutter, then then electricity on Shabbos would be fine. But he says that it's also a problem because the effects are on a macroscopic level and not a microscopic level. So now the next question is, once you say there's no isurim involved in gene editing, so would we say that it's going to be mutter? If it's kind of neutral, there's no isur, but there's no explicit heter for it, so would it be mutter? So Bleich quotes a famous Tiferes Yisrael, which is in source number 11, where he says that shekol davar shelo noda tam la'asar, if there's no reason to say something is asar, mutter hu b'li tam, then it's mutter for no reason, even if it's just neutral. There's no explicit reason why it's mutter. The lo b'skira Torah dvarim ha'mutarim kulam, rak dvarim ha'asurim, because the Torah doesn't asar, doesn't say every single thing that's going to be mutter, rather only it says the things that are asar. And Rashi already in Tmura is a forerunner of this idea when he's explaining why an animal which has been served as a vodazara, the Gemara Zahavimina, that's going to be mutter ba'ana, that you could get ana out of it. So Rashi explains, why would you think it'd be mutter? So Rashi says, neva chu mutter, delo ashkan da asr, because there's no place that says it's asr until the Gemara brings a source for it being asr. So we see this idea that if something's not us, if there's no Isurim involved, then potentially it's going to be Mutter. And Rav Bleich quoted this by his discussion about genetic engineering. So therefore, it seems like genetic engineering and both and gene editing also should be okay. So now the next question is the Hashkafic issues which are involved with gene editing. So changing the very core structure of our DNA can seem quite provocative. How can we're just mortals, and we're manipulating the DNA of another human being. Some argue that the editing of such a core component of life is the work of God and not man. Even some secular scientists have said this, that that's not our work, that's up to God, not us. So how does Yiddishkeit view this concept of playing the role of God and kind of playing the creator? What's the role of man in this world in terms of creation? So the Sefer HaChinuch in Source number 13, when he's talking about combining different species, so he explains the mitzvah, and he says, "Masharshe mitzvah, ki Hashem baruch hu bara olamo bechachma betfuna uvedas." That Hashem created this world with wisdom and with knowledge. Va'asav etzir kol atzuros lefi masha hayat tzorech inyano roi liyos mehunos kivana olam ubaruch hoyodea. That He created the world with everything with its specific purpose and the way it's supposed to be, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows. He knows better. And then towards the end, Ubiyosi Odeya Elokim ki kol asher asa umachon b'shleimus le'inyano shu tzarech b'olamo. He knows exactly what's needed in his world, and therefore, v'loyis arvo haminim pen yichasish t'musam v'loyitzab aleim rechaso. And therefore, you shouldn't combine the species, because then you're going to destroy the shleimus of the world, and Hashem's bracha won't fall onto those new species. So he says that you can't create a new species, because that's the domain of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that we don't know. Hashem knows better than us, and He created the world and its perfection, and we're not supposed to go ahead and create our own new species. And the Rabban as well, in this past week's Parsha, he explains the reason for kilayim by animals, that we can't combine animals. So he says, v'hamarchish neiminim, someone who combines two different species, mishana umachish b'maisa b'reishis, they're destroying maisa b'reishis, the creation of the world. Ki'ilo yachshov shelo hishim HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'olamo kol tzorech. It's as if you're saying that Hashem didn't finish creating the world. And He wants to add on new species into the Bria. So it's a problem, because it's as if you're saying that Hashem didn't finish creating the world and I'm going to finish it for Him. So both this Ramban and Sefer HaChinuch, the ideas are taken on by Rav Moshe Hirschler, who was Rosh Yeshiva here back in 1967 for 1 year. And he subsequently became a Rosh Yeshiva and HTC later on, and he wrote a bunch of books on medical halacha. So in his second chelik of Halacha Rafua, in source number 15, he goes ahead and he first starts off by speaking about the Dor HaFlaga and how they use their chachma for ra, they use their chachma for bad purposes, and they want to rebel against Hashem by building the Migdal Bavel. And he kind of compares the idea of gene editing, genetic engineering, to the Dor HaFlaga, of using their wisdom in the wrong way. And he goes on to say how risky it is to do gene editing and genetic engineering, both to animals and plants. And he says, even one day, we're going to come to changing human beings, and we don't know what it's going to cause. So he goes on about the risk. And then in his last paragraph, which is brought in source number 15, he says, Kol shone v'shinoi b'marechas habriya yesh bo choser emuna. That anyone who changes anything in creation, he's lacking in emuna. And then he goes on to quote the Ramban. So he applies this idea of the Ramban, which is by just mixing species, he goes and applies it to gene editing and genetic engineering as well. But Dr. Fred Rosner quoted Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Rav Norberth as arguing on this application of Refersher, because they say you can't compare kilayim and gene editing, because gene therapy, gene editing, is used to cure disease and to prolong life. So it's no different than organ donation, he says, which nearly all post-com agree is within man's license to heal, at least to receive an organ. So therefore, you can't say it's a problem because you're taking over Hashem's role in creation. And the Gorari on the spot also takes the Ramban to task for giving this as an explanation for kilayim. And he asks on the Ramban, why is this such a problem? You're saying that it's an issue that is as if you're saying that Hashem didn't finish creating the world and that we're going to finish it for Him. But the Maharal, the Gorari, asks, what's the problem with that? He says, he quotes a medrash in Bereishis Rabba, that Kol Davar Shehakadosh Baruch Hu Bara B'Sheishis Mei Bereishis Tzara Thikun. The medrash says that everything that Hashem created in the world needs to be finished, needs to be completed. Kama Achitin Litchon V'Lafos. Just like wheat stalks need to be worked on and formed into bread by human beings. And we're not saying by this that Hashem is lacking in his creation. That just like by Mila, a person wasn't born circumcised, we have to do it. And we have to complete the human being by doing circumcision. So what's the point in applying this idea that it's as if you're saying that you're finishing their creation? He's saying, what's the issue with that? That actually, it sounds like according to the measures, that's a good thing, that we're supposed to finish the creation. So the Bereishis Rabba is brought in Surah 17 also, which the Gorayah brings. And there is another Medrash, in Medrash Tanchuma Parshas Tazria, which quotes a famous discussion between Turnus Rufus, a Roman governor, and Rabbi Akiva. So Turnus Rufus asks Rabbi Akiva, what's better, the creation of man or the creation of Hashem? Or the creations of Hashem? So Rabbi Akiva responds back, surprisingly, that the creation of man is better. And the Turnus Rufus goes on and asks, that how can you make all the sky and everything in the world? Like, how could you possibly say that man's creation is better? And Rabbi Kiva responds back that don't talk to me about things that are lamala mi abrios, that we can control. Rather, talk about things that are in front of us that we could potentially control. So he asked Turner Surface, how come you guys get bris milah? Hashem gave you your body and he created you a certain way, and you are going ahead and you're changing it. So how do we have the right to do that? So Rabbi Kiva brings him all different types of breads and cakes, and he says, what's nicer, this or wheat stalk? And Torah Surface says, the cakes and the breads. So Rabbi Kiva says back that it's the same thing with Bris Milah. Like, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Dafka wanted us to be mashed in the creation, to finish the creation and bring it to its full fruition. And then he also says, why are we born with an umbilical cord attached to us that we have to cut when a person's born? It's the same thing, that we're created not in completion, and we have to finish that completion. And the Medrash says at the end, "Shelo nasan HaKadosh Baruch Hu hamitzvos ela tzarif ha'adam b'hem," that a person's supposed to be involved and be involved in creation through the mitzvos. Then the Maral, again, in source number 19, in his Tiferes Yisrael, kind of explains this Medrash a little bit more. And he says, "Ki maisa ha'adam b'mashu pal ha'adam shuhu bal seichel," that the creation of man and the involvement of man which involve seichel, yosef emadrega min ha'teva, are even higher than nature. Shehu koach chomri bavad. Ukomo she'ochiach lo min achitim shehu pal ha'teva, and which Rabbi Kiva proves from the wheat stalks, which are created by nature, by Kadosh Baruch Hu. Vuhu chaser ad sheyushlam ha'idea adam asichli, and then they're brought to completion through by man when he creates breads. Shemizeh tira ki pal seichel hu al ha'teva. That because we can see through this that a person's seichel is now involved. And he says that's a higher level than nature itself. And towards the bottom he says, that the nature is lacking. That the baby comes out attached to the mother with an umbilical cord, the mother needs to cut it. That nature isn't completely full in its creation. And there's no question why a baby comes out with the foreskin still attached, because the action of teva is not complete yet, and there's no ashlama, and man has to finish that creation. He has to bring it to its fruition. Lastly, there's a Gemara in Chagiga which mentions why does the Kadosh Baruch Hu use the lashon of the name of Shakai. Shin Dalad Yud. So the Gemara says, "Ani hu she'amarti lo amidai." I am the one who told my world to stop. So the Gemara over there explains that Hashem told the world to stop expanding because the world was ever expanding, and in order to inhabit the world, we needed the world to stop expanding. So he's mitzamtin his creation. So the Beis Halevi and in Sefer Bereishis in Parakut Zion, he gives a drash to this idea of using a lashon of Shakai of Shin Dalad Yud, that "Ani hu she'amarti lo amidai." So the Beis Halevi says, towards the end, "V'zehu she'amar lo ani she'amarti lo lami dai," Nikol habriya hinachti la'adam shi'igmerna. I left the bria for man to finish creating. Shamati lo nidai. I told the creation to stop, to arrest the development of creation, and I was telling man to finish, and I'm telling man to finish that creation. Kmo kein bria sa'adam, and so too with the creation of man himself. V'hashlama shalo hinachti al'adam shi'imo es'atma. I left the completion of man with the objective is for him to finish the creation of man, to do bris milah. So we see, according to the Beis Halevi and the Maharal and those Midrashim, that it's dafka a good thing to be involved in creation, and it's part of the directive of man from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Rav, in many writings, he kind of carries this idea of the Beis Halevi, of his great-grandfather, his namesake, and specifically in his description of Adam 1 in his Lonely Man of Faith. So I'll just read a little bit from it. So he says, there is no doubt that the term image of God in the first account refers to man's inner charismatic endowment as a creative being. Man's likeness to God expresses itself in man's striving and ability to become a creator. Adam the first, who was fashioned in the image of God, was blessed with great drive for creative activity and immeasurable resources for the realization of this goal. The most outstanding of which is the intelligence, the human mind, capable of confronting the outside world and inquiring into its complex workings. And he goes on to say later in that chapter, he says, man of old who could not fight disease and succumbed in multitudes to yellow fever or any other plague with degrading helplessness could not lay claim to dignity. Only the man who builds hospitals and discovers therapeutic techniques and saves lives is blessed with dignity. And he ends off the chapter about describing Adam 1 by saying that man reaching for the distant stars is acting in harmony with his nature, which was created, willed, and directed by his maker. It is a manifestation of obedience to, rather than rebellion against God. So we see that the Rav clearly does not agree with those scientists who say that we can't be involved in creation, that it's not our place. No, that we are supposed to be involved in creation, we're supposed to bring the creation to its fruition and be a co-creator. And Rav Walter Wurzberger, when he's explaining this idea of the Rav in a piece in Tradition entitled The Centrality of Creativity and the Thought of the Rav, so he explains that in opposition to doctrines which delegitimize reliance on science and technology to advance human welfare as a usurpation of divine prerogatives, Rav Soloveitchik developed the notion of Adam 1, who is summoned to exercise creativity as a member of the majestic community. He fulfills his divine mandate of becoming a co-creator with God by not passively submitting to the forces of nature, but by transforming them through the employment of rational faculties. In the Rav's view, when human beings engage in efforts to harness the forces of nature to the advancement of human welfare, they are carrying out a God-given task to become partners with him in completing the work of creation. Scientific and technological activities are not manifestations of hubris, but the response to divine directive to conquer the earth. So the Rav is saying that part of man's nature and responsibility is to be a creator along with Hashem and to be mashlim, the Bria. So based on these Makoros, these Midrashim, the Maharal, the Beis Halevi, the Rav, it seems that the position of Yiddishkeit is that we are dafka supposed to be partners with Hashem in creation, and we're encouraged to do so. And it's not a rebellion against Hashem to be mashal creation, as other scientists may have it. Rather, it's a directive from Hashem. And the use of gene editing for therapeutic purposes is a form of man expressing his creativity and being part of creation. And rooting out the genetic diseases from our very core seems like a very positive thing, and would be encouraged once it's deemed safe to do so, and assuming that you get out of the other halakhic issues and you pass on the hakel on those other issues which were raised previously. The new technology invests in mankind tremendous power and enables him to be a part of creation, and hopefully we can look forward to a better future with the betterment of mankind through gene editing using CRISPR and Cas9 technology. Thank you.
Thank you.